This morning we have two bills that came to us from the Education Finance Committee. Senator Stump, which one would you like to take first, and what's the path you'd prefer of the two bills?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think we'll take up Senate File 3064 first. And yeah, I think that would be the first bill.
And when the committee has before it Senate File 3064. Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and members, the Education Committee this year, our Education Finance Committee, has had to do some somersaults and twists and turns. And so as we usually come in with an omnibus bill, this year we were coming in with, obviously it's not a budget year as such, but we're coming in with some smaller items. And Senate File 3064 is basically a fund transfer, and we have seven items in this that our committee processed. Fund transfers, Anoka-Hennepin, as you look on under the section one there, was a proposal that Senator Betzel brought in. And it was to help try to address some extremely huge cuts that the district was making out there, and help them with that fund transfer. Elk River was a little bit in the opposite way. Oddly, Elk River is a district that has extreme growth, and they have not been able to keep up with their basically that type of growth, and so the fund transfer for that district was brought in by Senator Phoebe, and it was to try to assist the district through a very tough period when they're increasing in students, and also not being able to raise the revenues to accommodate that. Hayfield is a small school district. This proposal was brought in by Senator Sinjum, and I believe there it was a fund transfer that tried to address, I'm not sure, I think it was, this one was before us last year as well, but they have some very, very old facilities, and they were trying to make, facing some of the same problems a lot of districts are facing with declining enrollments and small school issues. Kenyon Wanamingo was brought to us by Senator Murphy, and that was included. And Medelia was brought in by Senator Fredrickson, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, if I can recall, I think that one was actually somewhat of a flood-related issue that goes back. And then Senator Lynch brought in the one at Rochester. There they had requested quite a bit larger number. They were in the process of selling some of the land that the school district owned, and so we had to sort through whether that land was actually how much of it was actually not held or any debt against that land, and so the $400,000 represents that piece that we felt could be transferred. And then St. Louis Park was brought to us by Senator Latz, and there they had closed a school, but the costs for maintaining that or completing that closure was a, they needed to have some revenues to finish the job of closing the school and making an orderly closure. So that those are the fund transfers, and a little bit of the rationale behind some of them. And maybe it would be a good point at this juncture to have Mr. Nauman go through the property tax tracking sheet that I believe you have as well, and point out the items that we had just talked about in Senate File 3064.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman and members, the tracking sheet that Senator Stump made reference to is the traditional tracking sheet that we bring to this committee with the omnibus bill. In this particular year, we've bundled both the anticipated levy effects for 3064 and 3063, a bill that you'll hear in a moment, together on the same tracking sheet. With respect to this bill, if you'll flip to the second page and look at lines 128 through 132, five of the levies that you that Senator Stump just walked through have a are considered to carry a levy increase as a result of making the transfer. And those numbers are carried there. So 400,000, 400,000, 500,000, 350, and 55 are carried as levy increases. The reason for that, of course, is that these are transfers from the debt redemption fund, which are part of the excess that school districts are required to levy to provide assurances to the bondholders. Though under the language of the bill, those dollars are transferred into, in most cases, the general fund budget of the district for operating purposes. When that money gets repurposed, it of course would not credit back to the taxpayers as would occur under current law, so we consider that a tax increase.
So, Mr. Malman, does that make this a need to be a House file?
Mr. Chairman, in my judgment, I think it would be prudent to make that happen, and I've visited with counsel about that, and I think we have a mechanism for you. If you'd like me to talk through that, I can.
And then there is a general fund cost, and where, because of the increased property taxes by $1.7 million because of the transfers, the interaction with the property tax refund program causes a $70,000 increase in general fund spending, and where are we going to carry that?
Mr. Chairman and members, fiscal staff has had some conversations about this, and I think that coming into the tax committee, we were not reflecting that on the spreadsheet, but our assumption would be, given the timing, in a normal process that we would that would be carried on the tax committee's tracking. Because your bills have processed already, we will assume that as a, in both cases, both for 3063 and 3064, there's an aid tracking sheet here. We will amend that after the tax committee acts positively on the bill, assuming that it does, and we will carry those numbers on that tracking for the floor.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, it might be a good time to contextualize the entire levies on the sheet. And this does sort of preempt the conversation on 3063 a little bit, but line 156 carries a $7.6 million levy effect on a one-time basis, levy increases. And we can talk about what that is in a moment when we get to 3063. But those plus that change plus the fund transfers generate... If you flip to line 199, total certified levies, a almost $4 million levy increase relative to the baseline. And I'm sure Senator Stump would want me to reiterate that that's a one-time levy effect that you notice that it doesn't continue into fiscal 2013. Taxes payable 12.
Senator Stump, does that conclude 3064?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does.
Chair is over Senate File 3064. In other words, I think we're going to have a discussion with Senator Stumpf about maybe putting these two bills together, so we'll just lay over 3064, and I'll take up Senate Bill 3063.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, briefly, Senate File 3063 was a bill that related to two issues, and then there's an amendment that kind of a technical amendment that we need to add. The one issue, both of the issues relate to the Alternative Facilities Revenue Program, and that is a program that certain districts can avail themselves to use bonding and levy to maintain their districts, and the cities of the first class as well as other districts, large districts, and the language relates, or the eligibility relates to basically the size or the square foot of the districts as well as the age of the buildings. And what was done in this case, since our budget had to be reduced, we had a target that we needed to meet. We ended up using in the Alternative Facilities Program aid part of it to cities of the first class. We reduced the aid part of it and changed that over to levy to the tune of, in this case, roughly 5.6 million aid reduction, and then consequently that would also translate into a levy increase for those districts. The other issue that you can see on the first page relates to the Wayzata School District, and there this would be effective in 2013, and it would allow them to participate in the Alternative Facilities Program. And periodically we have had requests over the years for districts to do that. I believe Senator Wieger a number of years ago, I don't know the exact year, 1999, I believe it was Maplewood and, oh no, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale was allowed to participate in this program. And so there's, I think, total about 22,
20. Mr. Chairman, I think we're up to about 25.
25 districts that participate in this program. I think a lot of districts would like to participate, but because of the eligibility requirements, many of the districts don't qualify, either because the smaller districts can participate in some other programs, but they would not be eligible for this. So that's what the bill does. The dollar amounts on the second page show the reduction, and the tracking sheet, if you look at line 156, as was pointed out by Mr. Nauman, you'll see the aid reduction.
So Senator Stumpf, is the Alternative Facilities Authority being given to Wayzata is there any aid cost to that, or is it all levy?
And I'll let Mr. Nauman explain. There's really kind of two components to that program, and one does have aid and the other one doesn't.
Mr. Chairman and members, as Senator Stumpf spoke to, there's about 26 school districts that currently are eligible for alternative facilities. Back in the 1997 tax bill, there was aid created to offset some of the tax rate compressions that were occurring at that time. To offset some of those, some school districts were given aid, and that was Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, a few others. that is the aid that's being recaptured here. And that's the second piece of the bill. When you talk about Wayzata, they would come in as an all-levy school district. Currently, they are levying about $3.2 million a year for their facility maintenance projects. Some of it's deferred maintenance, some of it's health and safety, and the school district has informed us, and we have writing to this effect, that they would cease doing that levy and replace it with alternative facilities levy. So those two will offset each other. You can see that under the tracking for fiscal year 2013 in that column.
Is that only because they have broader authority to use the levy money for more purposes than health and safety? Why would be their reason to replace the health and safety levy with this?
Mr. Chairman and members, the district feels that the alternative facilities is a preferable approach. They can bond under alternative facilities immediately for a larger construction project and then structure the debt service payment at the same amount that they're currently levying on a pay-as-you-go basis. So where they previously were having to sort of pick off maintenance projects on a year-by-year basis, they can take a larger holistic approach, take advantage of some of the lower construction costs right now, and then have a payment that would be the exact same amount as what they're paying.
So we're allowing them to incur additional debt in all this time of uncertainty?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
And how many of our, we have about 350 school districts, how many are eligible for the alternative facilities? Kind of what's the trigger that makes one school eligible and one not?
Mr. Chairman and members, under the permanent statute, there's a couple of thresholds. They basically key off of the age of your buildings, your average age of your building, and your square foot. So there's a high threshold and a low number of years and a lower age threshold and a higher number of age. And if you meet those criteria, you're into the program. But that does create a line, and Wayzata is just below the line, and they've asked to participate. We have done this on a couple of occasions. You can see that actually in the language of the bill because we're pulling in the session law from 1999. So the But you can see that Subdivision 1, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale were added, and Stillwater were added. Both of those districts subsequently grew sufficiently to meet the statutory criteria. Although, interestingly, in recent years, North St. Paul, I think it was about 2 years ago, North St. Paul, Maplewood fell below the criteria. So there was concern that they would fall out of the program. And thankfully, they had this provision they could point to and say, we were made eligible, notwithstanding the statutory provision, so they were allowed to continue. They were right on the bubble, so that it provided that advantage to them. Mr. Chairman, to address your concern about taking out bonds, some districts participate in this program as a pay-as-you-go program. They don't choose to actually take out bonds. Most do, but some choose to. And Wayzata has obviously told us that's their intention, but some will do it as a pay-as-you-go. The primary advantage to a school district is that they don't have to go to the voters for the purposes of a maintenance project.
And the cost of this bill is more.
Mr. Chairman, you mean the levy cost or
the general fund cost?
Mr. Chairman and members, the aid savings you can see on the other tracking sheet here, which does include Senate File 3028, which is on the floor. Senator Stump mentioned that there's a collection of E-12 bills moving, but if you look at line 3, you'll note that the effect of the aid and levy change in 3063 is a $5.6 million savings in fiscal year 11 due to the payment shifts that occur that also affect this program. There's an additional $2 million of savings in fiscal 12.
But isn't the $2 million in savings offset by the $315,000 cost to the property tax refund program?
Mr. Chairman, as we talked about previously, yes. Coming into this committee, we were not accounting for that because that's a traditional tax account that you would normally carry in your bill. Fiscal staff has worked it out so that coming out of this committee, this spreadsheet will be updated to reflect that cost. So, yes, there will be an offset of...
So your savings will go down.
The savings will go down reflecting both bills. So I think it was 70, and I'll have to remind myself at 350.
315.
Yeah.
I asked Senator Stump, I asked Senator Pogemiller and Senator Cohen last night what they'd like me to do with this bill. Because I know there has been some concern on the part of those first-class cities that receive this aid. And they both told me that we should pass the bill out to the floor. So I just want to be sure that legislators on this committee that represent those first-class cities are comfortable with doing that, because that's what I've been told by Senator Pogemiller and Senator Cohen. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I will support moving this bill out of the committee to the floor. I acknowledge Senator Stumpf and the work he's done. I mean, we were pretty concerned when the bill emerged from his committee. That most of his target was carried by this facility's aid that came out of only three cities. And this isn't just to be, for the record and to be clear, this is not some sort of a special perk per se that these three cities get. It was in recognition of a disproportionate share of a shift to residential property that occurred with the property tax rate compression that occurred a number of years ago. It was a way of, a way of the three cities kind of carrying a disproportionate share of a larger policy decision that affected the whole state, but figuring out a way to keep at least our residential property taxpayers whole. It kind of came as a surprise because there was no forewarning, and we learned about it after the fact and really needed to dig in and understand and articulate those concerns. And Senator Stumpf responded. And, of course, we're not thrilled with some of the solutions. We're in a difficult time in a tight box. And this is, I acknowledge, a relatively small amount in the grand scheme of things in light of the news yesterday and what we're facing next year, et cetera. But we really do need to struggle with and grapple with these decisions we make and the implications for local property taxpayers, both commercial and residential. So we've come down to half of what was originally proposed. 10% of the students in the in the state, and a small percentage of the property taxpayers will carry a large part of the target that we're trying to accomplish for E-12. Not thrilled, but certainly recognize we've made a ton of progress, and I'll certainly support moving the bill out of the committee today.
Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair, I think this will translate directly into a property tax increase for the residents in Duluth and Minneapolis and St. Paul. I just want to say that it will translate directly into a property tax increase.
And Wayzata.
Mr. Chairman, the Wayzata provision takes effect in 2013.
There's offsets.
Senator Wong, I'm sorry.
So I have a really hard time sitting here knowing what for the last 9, 10 years, Mr. Chair. We keep shifting, and we keep shifting, and we keep back away from our state obligation, and we keep putting the burden on the backs of the property taxpayers at the local level. And I'll tell you, I don't know how much more the property taxpayers in St. Paul, and for that matter in Minneapolis or Duluth, can continue to do this. My fear is that, you know, we view this as an incremental, as a small change in the big picture of things. But for contributing to this solution, does that buy us goodwill so that the next time around we're not asking to sacrifice yet again? Mr. Chair, and I hope that if this bill does get out of here, that the commitment is that this doesn't seal it. I mean, this is not it, and that we still have time as this is moving forward, and that we will continue to work, that this is a work in progress. I'm not yet willing to say that what's in this bill, once it leaves here, if it does leave here, that this is it. That I would like to feel that this is a work in progress, and that if ultimately in the next couple, 2, 3, 4 days, if this is where we have to be, then that's as a last resort. But I really just want it on the record and want the people in St. Paul and Minneapolis and Duluth to know that we at least have given, you know, everything that we've got to not make them be the only ones to bear the burden of this solution.
Sure.
Senator Dibble.
I just wanted to make one other observation, just building on Senator Moore's point. You know, we had, you know, the much ballyhooed Minnesota miracle of, you know, that's kind of predates all of us, and then kind of the update to the Minnesota miracle in 2001, in which we, you know, we're trying to address school financing in a progressive way, financing schools, our E-12, so we deliver an equal education across the state, and we do that out of our relatively progressive tax sources. And I think we pretty much unwound all of that. I mean, we just never were able to follow up with that commensurate commitment, you know, through state sources and the general fund. And I think we've pretty much unwound all of what we had hoped to accomplish in 2001. It seemed pretty obvious at the time that corresponding subsequent commitment in future years just wasn't going to occur. I voted against the bill because of the property tax rate compression in that year's bill and a number of other things that just seemed unsupportable and unsustainable. And sure enough, those have all come to pass. And, you know, I anticipate we're just going to continue to unwind even the original, you know, Minnesota Miracle, LGA, the picking up our funding commitments to schools at the state level, and we're going to be going back to a fairly unequal, uneven, and less progressive system across the state, and I think that's really, really a shame. I would be, you know, we should maybe dust off this report that our governor commissioned, and you know, one of the big three reports that he commissioned, and then decided to torpedo or bury because it came out with findings that he didn't like, and that was, of course, on education funding and determining that even a number of years ago, you know, we weren't delivering the kind of funding to education that would keep us on pace with our needs to be competitive nationally and internationally and deliver an equal quality of education across the state. It would be interesting to dust that report off again in this committee and take a look at it and just see how far afield we've gotten from the findings of that excellent blue ribbon bipartisan panel.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to my colleagues, particularly to those from the cities of the first class. I mean, I understand your concern with this change that's being proposed here, but, you know, rate compression occurred in our communities too, and we've already experienced this shift onto residential that you know, you were somewhat relieved of. That occurred then. So, you know, I know this is appears on the surface to maybe not be as equitable as one would like it, but, you know, all of the levy increases that were proposed, you know, we had communities that had high percentages of CI and experienced tremendous shift onto residential that some of your residents were relieved of. you know, you think, you know, I look at the agenda here, and it is evidently is not printed right, but there's career and technical levy. Used to be state aid. And the little bit of that program that left is all levy now. And, you know, so this is not just a city of the first class issue. And we have to kind of take a little broader view of all of this stuff. So understand your concerns. But, you know, you're not the only ones experiencing these property tax ramifications.
Sure.
Senator Squire, that bring. I was just thinking about that. This happened in '97. This aid category was put into law to recognize some rate compression. I was just thinking about the 2001 bill, when with the state education takeover, where we did undid the state gen ed levy. How some schools that I represent were impacted by the fact that a major piece of their tax capacity is seasonal rec, and their ability to be able to levy on that going forward after 2001 was taken away, and they lost a huge piece of their tax capacity, which ultimately shifted the entire burden of voter-approved levies onto CI and homes. And I do think that, you know, we've, and I appreciate this committee's support for, I don't know, probably 3 years, we've carried a provision to try and fix that. And the House and the governor have been unwilling to do that. But I do hope that next year it's a very similar issue to what happened here, just happened to happen years later. But that, Senator Stumpf, the problem that I have is this bill kind of violates one of my core principles relative to resolving the state's budget deficit. My belief is that in resolving the state's budget deficit, all Minnesotans across the state should participate in the solution. And that has been my objection to LGA cuts, as resolving the state's budget solution, is that not all communities participate when we go to a certain group of cities, or in this case, a certain group of schools, to help resolve the state's budget challenges. And Senator Stumpf, I realize we probably have to do this, but I just have to say on the record, this, just like the LGA discussion that this committee has had, really violates what I really believe, that we all have to participate in the solution here, whether it's finding cuts that spread equally across the entire state, or finding revenue that spreads all across the state where all Minnesotans participate in the solution. And this is just another example of an option we're putting out here that doesn't spread equally to all Minnesotans in solving the problem. Senator Stumpf, I understand behind the scenes why this is the approach, but I understand that, and we might have to do this, but it's not fair.
Mr. Chairman, just to maybe kind of elaborate on your point, the approach that we took, apart from kind of the framework that I had to kind of operate in, was to, and again, we did not have a huge target. I mean, I had $14 million in terms of a budget that we deal with is relatively small.
Senator Stumpf, what is the annual budget for K-E-12 in the state budget? How many billion?
It's about annual budget about $5.6 billion.
General fund spending.
General fund. And then I think levy-wise, it's probably a little over $1 billion or $2 billion. $2 billion. So
we spend $7.5 billion roughly a year on schools?
It's a large number, but it's also one of the largest, I'll call it a business, but it's an education business in the state. I mean, it affects every community. And what we tried to do, even on the $14 million, was to not go into the classrooms to make the cuts. All of the cuts that we made were made to grant kind of aid programs that were not actually classroom oriented. And that was kind of the premise that we operated on. And along with, you know, a lot of us and a lot of my colleagues will say, well, you only had to cut $14 million. Well, our office is tracking. Right now, they're set. The districts are, excuse me. The districts are setting their budget for next year. So we're tracking the amount of reductions that school districts are making across the state. Because of the personnel and stuff, they have to have that budget in place to know what they're going to deal with. Well, we have, as of maybe 2 weeks ago, I should look up the most current information, but as of about a couple weeks ago, we had school districts that had voted on actual cuts of $147 million in 37 school districts. So when we say we only cut $14 million from the education arena here, out there, there's massive cuts being implemented in across the whole state. And I wouldn't doubt if that number, by the time all the districts make their reductions and we tally them up, I bet it'll be well over $200 million that they'll cut. St. Paul's a big one. I mean, it's not just the big districts, but every district across the state. So, and it's not only that, but the state of Minnesota, through the unallotment process, changed the payment schedules by the tune of about $1.8 billion. And on top of that, the state of Minnesota is looking at those districts, the reserves, the cash reserves that those districts have, to pull that cash reserve out for cash flow purposes to run the state of Minnesota. So it's a whole combination of things that's impacting. And then to put the final kind of frosting on that scenario is that we're being asked, or the school districts are being asked, to deliver a more higher standard, a better quality education system for our children. And they'll do it. We do it already, but we're going to even increase that standard and then the quality over a period of years. No matter what happens or the verbiage that comes out of the West Wing, Minnesota delivers the highest quality education, one of the highest quality education systems in the whole United States and in the world. If you go back to, I believe in 2007 or 2008, we had funded a participation in what they call a TIMSS report. And this was many of the nations around the world, most of the best ones. And our students participated in that activity. And we came in like third in some places, fifth in some places. So there, you know, we can say there's areas, and there are areas that we need to move aggressively on. You've heard this, closing the achievement gap. And certain school districts that have been cited or identified for not making the kind of improvements that they need to make. But when you look at the education system in our state, it is among the best in the whole country. And so, I mean, we have a lot to be proud of. We have a lot to treasure. And Senator Dibble, when you say we have made erosions, you're absolutely right. I met with teachers and superintendents and board members, and there's many of our districts that are struggling. they don't have the resources they need. They have many of the best educators across the state are kind of worn out and frazzled, but yet they have that interest and dedication and concern about our children, and that comes through time and time again. There's something about Minnesota that the quality of the people is very, very high. So we will meet those challenges, and I hope, as you mentioned, Senator Bach, I hope next year we can maybe start, and it'll take several years, start building back to a system. The bill that might come up today on the reforms and I wouldn't say reforms, but changes or making available opportunities for changes, I think, and we'll have a good discussion, I'm sure, on the floor. We did in committees. I think is we should look at it in a positive way, because as society moves ahead from year to year, you have to make changes. I was talking to young children, and none of them knew what a phone booth was, because there are no phone booths anymore. And over my lifetime, you could take several of those things that have totally become antiquated just because of technology and just because of the way life changes. So our education system needs that too, but they do need resources too, and that's a big thing. They need resources, and they need the support and dedication from us as well.
Senator Stump, that's an interesting thought about phone booths, because I actually saw one just recently. I'm trying to think what town it was in. There are still a few around. Maybe the History Center on their Capitol tours should make a point of bringing the sixth graders by the freight elevator and show them the two payphones that are hanging on the wall, because maybe someday it'll be a very big part of a historical tour of the Capitol that people actually had to put quarters in a phone to make a phone call once upon a time. Because I think we still have two of them by the freight elevator, right?
I think they're still there. Yeah.
Well, they're there. I don't know if they get used, but I don't think we should take them off the wall, because they might be a part of Minnesota history someday.
I wonder if they actually work.
People don't believe it sometimes when I say things like this, but I remember when getting a push-button phone was a big deal, and I remember when you only had to put a dime in the in the payphone.
Anybody remember a nickel?
I remember we had one on the farm where we actually had to crank it. And it was all party lines.
Yep.
So you had multiple people.
We had our own line, but we had party lines in our neighborhood.
I had party lines in my neighborhood growing up, too.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of
Senator Stump, is there anything that we could do to kind of put school administrators or school boards kind of on notice that in the next budget, it's going to be pretty unlikely there's going to be new money for K-12. I mean, even if we were to go down further down this levy road, because we don't have general fund, in the next biennium, that levy money would only be available for 1 year of the second year of the biennium. It just seems like when you talk about all the cuts schools are making, it seems like they're making cuts based on some unrealistic budgets that they set. And it just seems like somebody ought to alert our schools that, we all want to go on the campaign trail and commit that we're going to put more money into education because, schools are part of the identity of our communities and there's huge support for them. But I just was wondering, is there some way that we can kind of, we all understand that we work under the dome here, but I think you don't have to get too far away from the Capitol and people lose sight of the challenges that we have here. And I'm just kind of thinking about this time next year, Senator Stump, we'll hear that schools are making more cuts, but to what extent were those cuts based on some unrealistic expectations that maybe we need to think about how we could temper some of those expectations relative to what the state can and can't do for them under the budget constraints that we have. You thought at all about how we could communicate that message to our school districts?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think the reality is out there that the actual budgeting that local districts are making are reflecting, I think, the availability of money from the state, whether it's what they might receive. I think the area that I think needs that will be addressed is in the whole area of kind of like what St. Paul and Minneapolis has gone through, Anoka's going through it, is in coming down in terms or recognizing what they need in facilities, how they have delivered services in the past that they can't really afford to deliver now. I think that adjustment is happening. It's painful. It really, people have a difficult time, our constituents have a difficult time understanding why they can't keep what they have. And in rural areas, one of the big challenges for us, and we've seen this for many years because the declining enrollment hit out there first for a number of years. And so we've had a lot of school closures, a lot of consolidations, a lot of cooperative kinds of efforts. And now we're kind of moving to this next phase where we have to kind of go in and do this all over again and move to larger or more groupings, districts working together and sharing resources. I think that's going to be another phase that we'll go through. Technology, you would think, would step in and say, "Oh, we'll this will be the answer." But I think it's just a tool. It's like those. I don't know if you have one of those things that those.
I have one.
You do. I don't. But
whatever it is, I have one.
I'd like one, but it's one of those things that does multi tools. I guess they call them, but they do all kinds of things, and they do them faster and better. Rather than, you know, using a chisel or a saw or something.
I have those too.
Yeah. So I think technology is a tool, but it doesn't take the place of people. And the teacher, all the research indicates that the greatest outcome for our children happens when you have the best teacher in that classroom. There's no substitute for that. I mean, you can have the best, fanciest school, all the technology, but if you don't have a good person, and part of it, I think, is relationship building and identifying with that person who's in that classroom. That's what really drives the education, and I think that's the same thing with parents. Parents that are involved with their children are giving them good example. That really drives what the outcome of what that person turns out to be. So,
but Senator Stump, I'm just kind of wondering, you know, if there is some kind of a reform or a new model, maybe let me use the kid that wants to be a carpenter, for example. Maybe we give him the opportunity to go off and work on his carpenter career after the 10th grade. And we take him out of the K-12 system. And we don't pay for him there anymore. We move him or her into the career path that they want to be on. When maybe they don't need to do for example, 11th and 12th grade in the K-12 system and incur that cost, that maybe that cost can be carried somewhere else. That it just seems like that's the discussion. Being a carpenter all my life, it seems like that's something we're trying to find a way to work within. It seems like school districts are, to a large extent, are setting their budgets based on the spending they need to do rather than on the revenue they have available. And I think that leads to, I think, sometimes some unrealistic expectations out in the community, when then they have to make cuts when they find out that the revenue doesn't match the spending expectations. So I think I think you're right. I think some of that is changing, but I think more probably needs to happen. We have these expectations, and then they're limited by the revenue. And I think school boards have to start to kind of think more on the revenue side and maybe kind of try to temper some of the expectations. Senator Watt?
Mr. Chair, I don't know about other school districts, but I'm very well aware that my school board and my superintendent are very keenly aware of the revenue expectations. And I think it's because based on the kind of formula that we've put together to fund, I think most school districts and most superintendents can count how many students they have. And up until these uncertain economic times, when teachers and school districts don't know at any given time how many children are going to be disappearing from their district, that creates some of the uncertainty from year to year. Whereas I think when we were in a more certain economic time, you could rely on the fact that a whole bunch of people aren't going to lose their jobs and they're not going to move out or move to a different place. And, you know, just track and look at the number of students who don't show up, who's in one school one year, who don't show up for school the next year. Part of the fact of the uncertainty that our school districts have to deal with is that we have such a destabilized economy and a destabilized population that it's hard, I think, as much as they try to predict, because of the way that we fund our schools based on the pupil and other types of formulas, that I think when your community and your students is destabilized, and that's kind of the indicator to you on where your income is coming from, I think that certainty is not something that the school board or the superintendent could control. And so that's one factor that I think is at play here. But in terms of, I think, the locals being realistic, I just think that we have completely shot any credibility whatsoever that we as a state partner have in terms of any kind of commitments that we have previously had to deliver on our partnership with our local partners, whether that's the school district or the townships or the cities. And I think while we may think that they are unrealistic, I think that they're much more realistic than we are, in that we may go out there and we people may campaign and say we're going to hold education harmless and, you know, we're going to continue to toe the line on LGA. What they're finding is that even if we say that, that's not what happens at the end of the legislative session, because something will always come up that will compromise that commitment. And it will be packaged in a fashion where we actually get to claim that we're holding them harmless. But in actuality, what we've done is we've shifted the burden onto them in such a way that we can continue to claim that we've been a committed partner. But in actuality, that's not the fact. And I think so. I think we have shot our own credibility at saying to them, I think they have known a long time, long before, you know, we started thinking about the long-term structural implications for them. I think many of them already have seen the light, and they're taking some of the drastic steps, Senator Sump, that you have referred to, because they see coming down the pipeline that they need to get themselves in place to create some structural cuts that will not only address the lack of follow-through that we have, not only in previous sessions and this session, but they know what's coming out down the pipeline. I know for a fact that that's what's motivating my school district. That's what's motivating the consolidations and the school closures that we're experiencing. And even at that dramatic of steps that we've had to take this year, we're still going to have a gap. Without the small change that's taking place today in this bill and this committee that may result in an additional $3 million, we're still going to, despite all the closures that we're experiencing and all the changes that we're making, we're still going to have a gap. This will add to that gap, and it will come directly, I think, out of the classroom now because we've done all the infrastructure things that we need to do. So I think it's been it was really great, Senator Sumpf, that you kind of set the context. And I think it's not because the locals don't know it. It's not because the school boards don't know it. And if there are school boards, school districts, and superintendents out there who don't know it, Senator Bach, they need to be told. But I know for a fact that my school district and my school board members know it well. And the pain that we're experiencing this year is our attempt to deal with a permanent structural forecast that we are seeing that will be coming down the pipeline here at the legislature. So I know for a fact that my school board and my school district is not putting our head in the sand and not seeing the reality of what's coming down the pipeline.
But I think my issue, Senator Moy, is not every school superintendent, not every school board member in the state gets one of the Twin City dailies that follows the legislative session and the challenges that the state is facing. And I'm not sure a lot of school boards in the state understand the uncertainty right now. There is a great deal of uncertainty going forward into the next biennium. And I have a different issue in my own school district, and I'm going to have my House members drafting a bill. I expect I'll get the Senate jackets in time enough to introduce it this year, and I've always been a supporter of open enrollment, still am. But I've got a situation in my own little hometown newspaper where a neighboring school district is running full-page ads that they now are going to bring buses into my little town, and they're setting the times that they're going to stop at the grocery store and the time they're going to be at the library to bus kids out of my little hometown 25 miles down the road to their school. And it's almost like, in these circumstances, we're going to cannibalize each other. And that doesn't seem very constructive in our communities. So I'm going to bring a bill that is going to have a discussion about, and I believe, Senator Stump, I need a history lesson on this, but it seems like when open enrollment was done, we didn't allow school districts to run buses outside of their school district boundary. And then somewhere along the line, it seems like that was changed, and we allowed them to go into other school districts and pick up students. And it just seems, the way it looks in my little hometown newspaper, the neighboring school districts are kind of feeding on each other, because it's the benefit of going into a community and picking up a student and getting that pupil unit outweighs the cost of running the bus there. Even if you run the bus 25 miles up the road and only get 3 students, the benefit of getting the pupil units outweighs the cost of running the bus there. So, Senator Stump, or Mr. Nauman, do you remember the history when open enrollment was passed? Where school did we prohibit school districts from going outside their boundaries? It seems, I thought I remembered, parents had to transport their kids to the district boundary, or was that just something that some school districts imposed, or what's the history of it?
Mr. Chairman, I understand some of your thinking on that. There's a couple of pieces that might be playing into it. When we passed open enrollment, there was never a restriction on school districts going into other districts. I think what I would suggest is there's probably been an honor system that has occurred, although I recall maybe 12 years ago visiting the South Kuchiching School District, and they were sending buses down into Black Duck at that point. So it has been happening. What I think you might be thinking about is that we do have a restriction that if a student is open enrolling from another school district, and based on the 1-mile limit, there is a requirement that if a parent gets the student to the district border, then there is a requirement that that student be bused within that school district. So if a Minneapolis kid were to be attending in the Columbia Heights School District, for example, and they got them up to 39th Street, at that point, Columbia Heights would be required to bus. I think it fits within that mile limit, but then they would be required to bus from 39th Street up to the high school.
I mean, Representative Dill has the example, I think, that most people can understand, because most people probably understand the intersection. If you go up Highway 53 towards International Falls at Captogama, where there's a big fish that lots of kids in Minnesota have had their picture taken sitting up on the saddle of the fish, the entrance to Captogama National Park. If you, Representative Dill claims, if you sit at that intersection in the morning, it's in School District 2142's boundary, that if you sit there that morning, you will see a bus from International Falls go by into that school district to pick up a kid. And you'll see a bus from Little Fork go by to go down the road into Captogama, Dead End Road, to pick up a kid. And then you'll see the bus from 2142, whose district it is, go by to pick up a couple kids. And it just kind of, for me, understanding the situation, because it's in my district, it seems like there's a lot of duplication going on that's adding a lot of cost. And I kind of wonder how much of that around the state is there, because it is cheaper to, the benefit of getting the one student 3 miles down the road is greater than the cost of running the bus. How much of that, Senator Scoia, is that going on in your district? How much of that is going on?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think you're exactly right. In Park Rapids, you can get on the Monaga School District bus, the Nevis School District bus, or the Park Rapids School District bus. And if you're on the west side of Bemidji, in Solway, you can get on the Bemidji School District bus, the Bagley School District bus, or the Clearbrook-Gonvick School District bus. It's happening all over, and it's because of the formula that is totally driven by the number of kids and not by the cost of operating a school.
Seems like we're cannibalizing each other, Senator Stump.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have local control, and that's a, you know, as you mentioned, it's a determination on the part of the board or the board's decisions. Those students and the parents, obviously, in our area, you know, parents will make a decision with, if they have a, sometimes they want their children in a smaller school setting versus a bigger school setting. Or, you know, the unfortunate part where you have, let's say, consolidation sometimes, you'll have kids going in several directions because some will be closer to a different district. Some will be upset with the new board. They just don't want to go to send their kids to that the new school. And it is going on. I mean, we could look at maybe I think it would be good to look at that. Senator Bonhoff had a proposal last year to look at three districts, and these are suburban districts. I think they were Wayzata, Hopkins, and Edina, to see if there wouldn't be a way to bring the busing together. And I think that might be one way to try to address it, so that each individual district isn't operating their own systems. Duluth stopped using mass transit to bus their students, or because they had an accident or something. I forget exactly what the situation was, but there is a lot of things that we could. Or I should say, maybe not we, but that changes that could be made to save money. One thing that's occurring is that the open enrollment usage of open enrollment is going up dramatically, and part of it is the parents' decision and the students' decision to take advantage of college, earning college credits while they're in high school, and consequently lowering their costs when they go to college.
What is that, open enrollment?
Through open enrollment, yeah, post-secondary options.
And isn't that a different program?
Well, yes, it is. But what I was saying is that there's a financial decision that parents and students are making, because our tuition in colleges have gone up so rapidly that students now are saying, more students are saying, you know, I'm going to get college credit while I'm in, you know, in high school. And
is it free?
The school district pays for that. Yes.
So does the school district make any money on that? I mean, they don't have to. They get the money from the state, $10,000 a pupil or whatever it is, and then they have to pay the college to educate the kid. So if the college is incurring all the cost, does the school district have then a windfall? They have the pupil unit, but the only cost they incur is the cost they pay to the college.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nome?
The way that formula works is that about 88% of the pupil unit is retained at the district, and then the Department of Education pays the higher ed institution directly for the balance. So you're essentially splitting the pupil unit based on a percentage.
But doesn't the K-12 school not have to educate the kid?
Well, I think the way that the schools would respond, I mean, certainly this does act as a bit of a disincentive for schools. That's what some of them would argue, because they're losing some of their kids. But, yes, they are losing some of the time of the education. We're not talking 100% of the time in most cases. It's a class here or there.
Right. it's back to the uncertainty issue that I raised. How does my school district, now that the neighboring district is running an ad in the newspaper with a bus schedule, how is my school district supposed to have any idea how many pupils they're going to have in the fall? I mean, at a minimum, should we allow them to not advertise and set a bus schedule in a neighboring district? I mean, there's this huge uncertainty. If we're just going to cannibalize each other and steal students from each other, how am I going to know in September how many pupils I'm going to have? And it seems like because of the budget circumstances, the situation's getting more dire and the competition for students is getting more intense. So now we're actually advertising in neighboring districts, setting bus schedules to see if we can get some pupil units from them.
Mr. Chairman,
it's a discussion your committee has to have, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, we'd welcome to have you on our K-12 committee.
I think you meet at the same time, though.
Oh. I'm sure we could probably make some arrangement. Actually, Senator Osteen had a proposal, and it's in the policy bill that's on it's actually in rules, I guess. But there's a provision to limit the amount of advertising. It's not just our school districts, too, because you have now there's more and more private institutions that are educating. And because the system is relatively open. His proposal would limit the amount of money that could be used to advertise. And I think it's at 5%. I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, I think it's at 5% to try to limit that, the very problem that you're talking about. But between public schools, there's no regulation there. And then I think the first thing to do is to be sure that the districts are talking to one another so that they don't, I mean, they both have, or all of them have stakes in what happens. And we need to find a way to try to figure out how they can save money by sharing and pooling. In southwestern Minnesota, there's 25 school districts that have done just that. They've gotten together. They have looked at sharing resources, and the service co-op was kind of the hub of that. And what they're doing is looking at, well, we can't afford to hire a Spanish teacher for full time, let's say at a small district. Well, they're learning how they can share these resources, both personnel as well as real, you know, property type resources. And I think just getting those districts to talk to each other and figure out how they can get a maximize their dollars, I think, is probably the first steps, anyway.
Seems like that makes more sense than trying to figure out we can steal students from each other.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to leave without, we do have a couple of amendments to that.
I was hoping we'd forget about your bills. Oh, we're out of time. Well, Senator Ortman, you want to get into this?
Just a little bit, Mr. Chair. I have a daughter who's a senior at Chaska Public High School. I also have a 10th grader in Chanhassen, which is the perfect option for a 12th and 10th grader that don't really get along. They're going to separate schools. it's diplomacy in the Chaska School District. But Ellie is a 12th grader, and she leaves school every day to go to the community college, Hennepin County Technical College, to become, she's in the certified nursing assistant program. And the state does pay for her to do that. And so she's hardly at school. She leaves school, goes to community college, gets credit, and will become a certified nursing assistant by the time she graduates from high school. And they don't have the costs to educate Ellie or to bus her because she can't possibly ride the bus and get back and forth. And I just think that education is changing so much as we go forward. We have the same issue as your districts in the Norwood Young America School District. They are competing and not very well for the students that want to go to Waconia and want to go to Chaska. And so there's this terrible drain on the school district. And I think that with all these changes that are going on, I wonder, when are we going to talk about consolidation? I know it's a very difficult conversation to have, but we have so many school districts and they are duplicating their efforts. And I wonder if there is some benefit to consolidation in some of these areas. Uncomfortable, everybody wants their own school. Thus the Chaska-Chanhassen thing, and we had a great high school, but now we decided we needed to have one in Chanhassen as well as one in Chaska. And so I wonder, does every community get to have all the schools that they want? Do they all have to be managed locally, or could they maybe be managed and administered a little bit more regionally rather than in small school districts? And I think we have to look at those kinds of issues, because I don't think that we can afford all of the administration, all of the management costs for these schools, and the competition is hurting them all. So I think we should have that conversation. I'm not looking or lobbying for a seat on the education committee next year. I just think we should just have that conversation. I think it's overdue.
None of us, Senator Ortman, should be presumptive that we'll be reelected.
Correct.
Great deal of uncertainty. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, Senator Ortman, we have had programs at the state. We had the old CNC money that encouraged school districts to, I think it was cooperate and consolidate or whatever the CNC stood for. In the rural areas, in the school district that I live in and served on the school board, we did combine schools. And what's happened in a lot of parts of the state is the consolidation isn't as much of an option as it used to be because the travel times are so great that students would be spending, you know, multiple hours on the bus going to and from school. And so that's why when Senator Stumpf was talking about this program that these 25 rural school districts are doing where they're maintaining their building but they're sharing staff and other services, that's a pretty attractive option for parts of the state where we are geographically spread out, and you know, instead of moving kids around, maybe we can move other things or do other sorts of programs to share. So but you know, the question I was going to ask is maybe we ought to look back at that old CNC fund and see if there isn't something we can do to encourage what those 25 school districts in the Southwest are doing.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, I did have a meeting with a number of districts that, and in particular up on the range, that are actually looking at that. I mean, there's a lot of things happen in different times. And I think our area up in northwestern Minnesota, because of the sparse population, it kind of occurred first. And then now it's kind of coming down, and now it's actually occurring down here where you have declining enrollments and you have districts making decisions about closing schools and a whole host of tough decisions. But up on the range, I think, is an area that they have some good things, but yet there's a lot of small communities too that are talking to one another. And I think if we look at some incentives, again, through like the cooperation and combination, some of it is built around personnel issues, old debts, a whole host of things, facilities. And so I think that is one thing that I want to do to try to encourage those kinds of discussions. And I think there's some gains that we can be made. And then also, like I mentioned, in the transportation end of it, I think that's an area. Get those districts talking to one another and try to encourage efficient use of the resources.
Mr. Chair, I would just say I don't think that consolidation necessarily means closure. It doesn't have to. Maybe it does in some circumstances because it makes sense, but I know that in my district, and I'm sure as in all of yours, every local community wants to have their school because it's their school means, whether it be elementary or high school or middle school, it means that there's a library there, there are resources there, there are events there, and they're participating in their community. It's a community driver, so nobody wants to see no school in their community or have that school closed. But consolidation doesn't necessarily have to mean closure, and I think most people would agree with that there are some gains in economies of scale if these school districts were run in a bit broader a sense, because geographically some of them are very close, and you wonder if there aren't some economies of scale if they couldn't manage them in a consolidated fashion.
Senator Stump, we have a technical amendment. We probably should get your bill in shape here before we run out of time and forget to move it out of here.
Mr. Chairman, the A8 amendment is a technical amendment.
Senator Skoy moves the A8. Council, what does it do?
Mr. Chairman, I know you weren't directing the question at me, but I drafted the amendment. It corrects a, we should have said obligation instead of obligations. We clarified some of the formula that is designed to do the alternative facilities aid calculation. Previously, when the bill came out of division, it eliminated all the aid from the three districts in question, and we had to reorganize the language kind of quickly in Finance Committee. So this cleans up some of the changes that we needed to make, and I think it makes it read a little clearer.
So it would be fair to tell Senator Cohen that the Tax Committee is cleaning up his committee's work?
Mr. Chairman, I think you could say that. I think more accurately, you're cleaning up my work.
I'd rather blame Senator Cohen. On the Skoy motion to adopt the A8, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like the record to reflect that we have a great professional staff.
The Tax Committee.
All staff at the Capitol are great and professional.
And they do a lot of work on the fly. You can see that in this room yesterday morning when I had a little proposal to build a football field in here, and staff was doing a very, very good job on the fly because Senator Olsen had some different ideas than I had. But they did get it done, and we got it moved out. So. Other amendments. Senator Skoy, is there another one that you have? Or?
The A7 amendment. And Mr. Chairman and members, this is an amendment that actually was...
Senator Skoy moves the A7.
This is an amendment that actually was part of the other the policy bill, and then I ended up, since it was policy, this was more relating to the levy than to policy. We took it out of the policy bill and would like to have that included. And what it is that it's... relates to
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could help.
Mr. Norman?
Under current law, and I think this goes back to maybe the 19 or 2000 time frame, the Technology and Information Education System, which is kind of a consortium for districts that in the metro area that choose to belong, have been given authority to use some lease levy authority to levy to purchase a building, sort of a lease purchase. And they're about at the end of that lease purchase agreement, and they would still continue to have that levy authority, but they've requested to be able to, in a sense, repurpose that levy authority. The Education Committee has organized this in a way so that it doesn't create any net increases to the levy authority, but just changes the purpose for which the dollars can be used so that they can now do some improvements to that building.
So it doesn't extend an existing levy?
Mr. Chairman, it actually places a limit where there isn't one now. You'll notice the language in the amendment on 2.5 and 2.6. This levy authority theoretically exists forever. What this language does is limit it so that it doesn't extend beyond 2021. And it actually places a dollar cap, which the $632,000 is roughly the exact amount that they're well, I shouldn't say roughly exactly. It's what they're levying now.
Currently.
And I know there are representatives here that can speak to this more directly.
So, Senator Stump, did this pass out of your committee?
Yes, it did. It was in a different bill, though.
And then where was it?
Policy.
And where was it taken out?
It was taken out in our committee. We had the hearing in the policy bill, which was heard in our committee, included this, and then we took it out. And at that time, because of we wanted the policy bill to go directly to the floor because it was in the policy committee, and not have these provisions. So we had three provisions that we took out. This was one of them. The other two are going on a couple, I'm not sure where the other two are.
Mr. Chairman, we did not, as you know, we have not created an omnibus bill out of the Education Division that is of a finance nature. These are provisions that were sort of on the bubble of being kind of financy, but not completely. Someone's going to laugh at me for saying that. I think what happened was that when the bill was originally brought to the committee, I think it was the Senator Bonhoff bill, it was in a slightly different form. The committee looked favorably upon it and laid it on the table for possible inclusion. When there wasn't a finance package, Senator Stump took the option of taking the reworked language and putting it in the policy bill. Senator Cohen expressed a desire to see that policy bill as a result of this provision and two others, at which point Senator Stump took a separate option, stripped them out of the policy bill so that that bill could go directly to the floor, and now is looking for other places for those three potential finance options.
So they were in the bill at one time and then taken out.
Yeah.
Just trying to understand what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Senator Stump would suggest that they weren't taken out as a result of objections by the committee,
right,
but more just that there was it was not the proper vehicle for them.
On the SCOI motion to adopt the A7, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails. Are there any other amendments? Senator Stump, do you have anything?
64 into 63.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman, I think it would be helpful if we would move Senate File 3064 and amend it into Senate File 3063.
Senator Scoy moves that the contents of Senate File 3064 that is on the table in front of the committee, that the contents of Senate File 3064 be offered as an amendment to Senate File 3063 as amended.
Right.
Inserted
right after page.
Inserted after line 2.20. Any discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails. Senator Scoy, anything further? Or Senator Stump, anything further?
No, thank Mr. Chairman and members. I don't have anything further.
No reason to go to finance?
I don't think so.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nauman?
We've been there. I think that you're okay.
Go back.
Just that the amendment that we just put on,
Mr. Chairman,
purely tax.
Mr. Chairman, that amendment has already been through Finance Committee. They have already seen it, and it is pure tax because there's no longer any equalization of any substance in those districts. So it is there is no aid effect. It's just property tax.
Senator Skoy moves Senate File 3063 as amended be recommended to pass. Discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Thank
Senator
you,
Stump, Mr. Chairman. Norman, thank you. Thanks for the education.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? We, as a result of yesterday's Supreme Court decision, it's likely we're probably going to have another meeting or two before this session is over, I would think. So. Stay tuned. Anything else, members? Committee's adjourned.